Chapter 21, The Rainbow. Thinking about it later, Phyllis said that the one thing she remembered above all else about that week was the rain. A cold, driving rain from low-hanging clouds that never let up and never let the sun peek through. But then, that Sunday morning as she pulled her car into the hospital parking lot, something strange happened. Phyllis had just read a text message from one of the prayer groups in Boston saying, "Expect a miracle." As she pondered just how much of a miracle she should expect, she helped Mom step out of their car, and they both commented that the rain had stopped. To the east, the sun was shooting its rays through a chink in the cloud cover, lighting up the lovely, ancient mountains to the west and the layer of cloud above as well, giving the gray clouds a golden tinge. Then, looking toward the distant peaks, opposite to where the mid-November sun was starting its ascent, there it was, a perfect rainbow. Sylvia drove to the hospital with Holly and Bond for a pre-arranged meeting with my main doctor, Scott Wade. Dr. Wade was also a friend and a neighbor and had been wrestling with the worst decision that doctors dealing with life-threatening illnesses ever face. The longer I stayed in coma, the more likely it became that I would spend the rest of my life in a persistent vegetative state. Given the high likelihood that I might still succumb to the meningitis if they simply stopped the antibiotics, it might be more sensible to cease using them, rather than to continue treatment in the face of almost certain lifelong coma. Given that my meningitis had not responded at all well to treatment, they were running the risk that they might finally eradicate my meningitis only to enable me to live for months or years as a once vital, now unresponsive body, with zero quality of life. "Have a seat," Dr. Wade told Sylvia and Holly in a tone that was kind, but also unmistakably grim. "Dr. Brennan and I have each had conference calls with experts at Duke, the University of Virginia, and Bowman Gray Medical Schools, and I have to tell you that everyone, to a person, is in agreement that things do not look good. If Eben doesn't show some real improvement within the next 12 hours, we'll probably recommend discussing termination of antibiotics. A week in coma with severe bacterial meningitis is already beyond the limits of any reasonable expectation of recovery. Given those prospects, it might be better to let nature take its course." "But I saw his eyelids move yesterday," Holly protested. "Really, they moved, almost like he was trying to open them. I'm sure of what I saw." "I don't doubt you did," said Dr. Wade. "His white blood cell count has come down as well, and that's all good news, and I don't for a minute want to suggest that it isn't. But you need to see the situation in context. We've lightened Eben's sedation considerably, and by this point his neurologic examination should be showing more neurological activity than it is. His lower brain is partially functioning, but it's his higher level functions that we need, and they're all still completely absent. A certain amount of improvement in apparent alertness occurs in most coma patients over time. Their bodies do things that can make it appear that they're coming back, but they're not. It's simply the brainstem moving into a state called coma vigil, a kind of holding pattern that they can stay in for months or years. That's what the fluttering eyelids are, most likely. And I have to tell you again that 7 days is an enormously long time to be in coma with bacterial meningitis." Dr. Wade was using a lot of words in an attempt to soften the blow of a piece of news that could have been spoken in a single sentence. It was time to let my body die.